Hi, this is Michael Cortese of Noble Spirit in Pittsfield, New Hampshire.
And this is Charles Epting of H.R. Harmer Auctions in New York City.
And this is Conversations with Philatelists.
Michael, who is our conversation going to be with today? Who are we chatting with?
Well, I'm ridiculously excited because our conversation today is with Wade Saudy.
Wade, for those of you, and he's one of my favorite people in the hobby. He was one of the first people to support me and really help me when I was getting involved. But Wade's resume, his rap sheet in the hobby is second almost to none. Wade, I knew him first. I think he was immediate past president of the American Philatelic Society when I joined. He has served on the boards of societies, the Classic Society, you name it. He organized the New York 2016 World Stamp Show, which was my first major international show I ever went to. He signed the role of Distinguished Philatelists, which is the highest honor that anyone can receive. He received the Liechtenstein Medal from the Collectors Club. Really, if there's an award that's been given out in the hobby, I feel like Wade has gotten it at one point or another.
Yeah, you're actually making me a bit nervous to speak to him.
Luckily, despite his reputation and his resume, he is genuinely one of my favorite people to talk to. Whenever I'm at a show, if I can grab lunch or breakfast with him, I know that I'm in for some real laughs. He's always good for a joke or two.
Yeah, very easygoing and involved in the YPLF with Alex.
Absolutely. Well, again, when I first started getting involved in the hobby seriously, Wade was unbelievably kind with his time, with his expertise, with his encouragement. He's always been a real cheerleader of that program and certainly a big part of why I'm where I am today.
Right. Yeah. He's the not at all an intimidating introduction to the hobby.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people would be roped in if Wade was one of the first people they met.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's get him on the line. Let's get Wade spliced in here. I think he's out on Long Island now, normally a Brooklynite, but let's get Wade in the chat room with us.
Perfect. Yeah, here we go.
Wade, it's good to see you. It's been several months since I last saw you in person, so it's good to reconnect over Zoom.
Yes, that's the last show I was at was in early March at Garfield Perry.
I think it's been 7 years for us, though.
Has it?
Yeah. I don't remember, at least three or four. I remember which show specifically. But I remember seeing you just before the 2016 World Show.
When were you in Monaco?
2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I'm always right? In Monaco. I'm a member, so I was there.
We must have seen each other then.
Yeah, I know I've seen you.
Wait, he must have avoided you the whole time.
It's unusual to see somebody that doesn't have gray hair in our bodies. I remember that. I don't remember the names of most of the people, but I remember youth. My youth alarm goes off.
Wade, I think a lot of people in the hobby know you for different things, whether it's your leadership for the international show in 2016, your involvement with the APS as past president, your involvement with the Classic Society. Before we get into that, can you talk a little bit about your interest in philately? When did you get started? How did you get involved? What is it that you've... Because you've even surprised me sometimes. We've had conversations about different things you've collected over the years. Can you talk a little bit about what it is, your journey up until the present day in philately?
It's a big swath you want there.
We have a couple hours.
I don't. So let's see if we can do Campbell's soup on this or something. Well, I got started in the hobby when I was about 5 or 6 years old. My aunt gave me a stamp album, a worldwide stamp album. For someone who lived in middle-class Brooklyn at that time, a worldwide stamp album without someone to show you what it was kind of like one of those presents that you don't open even. They didn't have regifting then, but it might not have been it would have been a thought. But fortunately, her husband was an official at the United Nations in New York City. And when I told my mom that I filled all the stamps of the U.S. stuff, because this was a beginner album kind of thing. And, you looked at the incoming mail, but I didn't get mail from foreign countries back then. So I said, Mom, I've only got like these many pages and all these other pages, empty, not a stamp in them. So she spoke to my aunt, who spoke to her husband, and suddenly I was flush with cutoff stamps from covers. Hundreds and hundreds would come every month. And that kept me busy, and I kept that for a while. And then when I got old enough to spend my own money, I started collecting U.S. because I could get it easily and so forth. And I'd go to there were three stamp stores in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, in one little neighborhood in Brooklyn, had three stamp stores, all within a mile's walk of my home. So I would go to them and see, like, this guy wanted 7 cents for this stamp. This guy only wants 5 cents. Because that's how they were priced. They were used, you know, basically. And, you know, you had to shop around to see the best bargain. So you could do that. So I started collecting backwards. You know, the car was, this is the late 1950s. So I went back to the 1940s. I started collecting Praxis used. I never had the $1, $2, or $5, but I had the other ones used. And I just kept collecting until I took my entire stamp collection and traded it for a coin collection. Don't know why, don't remember why, and started to collect coins, maybe because they were more tactile and you could find them. You know, you didn't have to buy them. You could basically, back in those days, silver coins were everywhere. They hadn't taken silver out yet. And I started collecting coins. And then at some point when I got a little bit older, into my early teens, I spent that money on a date. I sold my coin collection and used it to further my my relationships with the fairer sex, as they say. I don't know if that's politically correct anymore, but I'm 71 years old and frankly don't give a damn. So that's the way it was. So I left the hobby till I was in my 40s, early 40s. And what caught my eye is I'm in my office and we get a lot of mail because I was in the consulting business. So we get tons of resumes and job requests, and, you know, mail would be probably 30 to 40 pieces a day to my attention. And it was my company, so I could get everybody else's mail. And I started seeing these transportation coils, and they were on white, bright white paper, and a single engraved one color image of some type of transportation. And it fascinated me. And I started to collect different ones. And that got me hooked. And I started collecting that. I went to plate number coils when I found out that these stamps had plate numbers. And I became smitten with the hobby once again. And that was like 1981, I guess, something like that. And ever since then, it's been a wild ride.
So do you still collect plate number coils?
No, I sold those for about 10% of what I paid for them, I guess, 25 years ago. I think it was the first thing I ever sold. First collection I ever sold.
And what was the first thing you bought after that?
Oh, well, I didn't stop there and start something. I weaned myself out of plate number coils and started to collect other stuff. I was collecting one of each mint in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And in the 19th century, basically used back to U.S. 1 and 2. And so I guess that was time-consuming. And then I sold my 1869 fancy cancels on stamps. And then I sold my banknotes. I sold tranches of things here and there and started to specialize in the 1847, 1851, 1861 era, the first three basic issues of the United States. And I still collect. I sold my 47s to Mr. Bill Gross about 15 years ago, I'm guessing, something like that. And I still collect the 51s and 61s, cancellations, markings, usages. Or as Michael Lawrence likes to say, uses. He doesn't like that word, usages. And I collect a lot of other things. I collect the Liberty Series postal history. I collect the parcel post postage due stamps of 1913. I actually got a gold medal the last time there was a summer show. A large gold. First time I exhibited. 6 grams. So that was fun. And I collect other stuff. I collect Black Americana, as it's called, which is really something I don't want to go into right now with our political climate. But I collect about 5 other things here and there. Crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah.
World War II patriotic covers, which are filled with politically incorrect stuff. Nazi covers, you know, propaganda covers, showing how ludicrous everything was. Mm. Just to get on the record with all the stuff I collect is to show how bad and evil it was, not because I'm a neo-Nazi. I want to be clear on that. It's important. You can cut this part out if you don't think it's appropriate. But you know, I find it fascinating how people were duped into believing stuff so simply, so easily.
Wait, there's a lot of great collectors out there who never get involved in the both the communal and administrative sides of the hobby. There's a lot of people who are content. They've got their collection. They buy at auction. They buy from dealers. But they never step up and assume any sort of leadership role. You're the opposite of that. You have contributed immeasurably to the hobby, I would say, both in your tenure as APS president, your role at the Classic Society, and as I mentioned earlier, the New York 2016 show. What was it that compelled you to, I guess you could say, give back to the hobby, to not just be content sitting there filling spaces in an album? What made you want to go further with your participation in organized philately? Because I personally, I think it's incredibly admirable, and I want to thank you for everything you've done as well.
Of course.
Thank you, guys. It's actually a selfish reason, I think. I never really analyzed it. I'm kind of like I don't want to say I fly from the seat of my pants, but I do what I feel comfortable with doing. So some people have personalities that lend toward certain things, and others have different personalities. I think that human beings often do what brings them pleasure. At least I do. I don't do it I want to help this person. I want to do it because it makes me feel good to help other people, not only because it helps other people. It's a selfish reason. It's kind of like Atlas Shrugged, if you've ever read that.
I was just about to call you Mr. Ayn Rand.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a definite pleasure that I get from doing these things. And if I didn't, I wouldn't. I don't do things in my life that I don't enjoy, whether or not it's how it affects others. But I'm fortunate that the things that I do choose to do can help others in many cases.
And it must have been very fulfilling for you to see the New York 2016 show be pulled off as successfully as it was. I can imagine that would have been a
wildly successful
ride for you.
Yeah. That was one of the most nerve-wracking things that I've ever done in my life. I didn't sleep for almost a week after the show with any kind of comfort. And then for about a month after the show, I just didn't know where I was. The pressure of that was just immense. The help that I got from the people that worked with me made the show possible. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I don't want to call it an army because that's a cliche, but you know, it's like the people that you're surrounded with make the difference. The people in the trenches, the volunteers. We had 450 volunteers.
Wow.
450. Yeah. And I'll make it up because I really don't know, but probably half of those people had nothing to do with stamp collecting or philately. These were people that were just older people that had some time. Some young people too, that wanted to do something at the Javits Center and be a volunteer, and that's what made the show successful. Not one person's efforts or five people's efforts. It was the well-oiled machine of everybody working together for a common goal, and it was very successful. We did very well for the hobby. We're able to give financial assistance to several organizations in the hobby. And it was a pleasurable experience, but it was draining for me. I'd put a couple of shows on at Belfont for the Classic Society in 2009 and 2012. And they, one was attended by about 350 people, and one was attended by about 225 people, let's say. And, you know, we had exhibits, and we had a bourse of about 10, 12 dealers, and made some money for the APS. We split the money with the APS because they hosted us. And I think the first time we made 10,000 each, and the second time we split like 14,000 with the APS. So those were successful. And that was it. That was the only shows I ever put on. And this was a learning experience. The hardest part of World Stamp Show was dealing with the decorators. Because with the decorators, who wound up spending $1.1 million with, just to put things in perspective, the Javits Center space only costs $900,000, but the decorators cost $1.1 million. They give you a menu, and they say, this is how much it cost for this. There's no contract, per se, that says this is how much you will spend to do your show. But rather, they give you a menu, and then they let in, you know, thousands of people, and they see who ate what, and then you get the bill. So it was harrowing because we didn't know if we were going to make money. We had no, I'm used to doing things where it's really clear when I get into it what I'm going to be, what my income and expense levels are. And with this, between the decorator and then the Javits Center labor, which was a separate bill, and the room guarantees for the Marriott system were nerve-wracking. But as it turned out, I think we made a little over $500,000. But it could have been the other way for all I knew the day before. I just didn't know because you couldn't quantify anything. So it was nerve-wracking. Anyway, it turned out to be a decent show. People seemed to have a good time. The dealers, by and large, seemed to be enamored with it, which was good.
Wait, what was the attendance on that again?
Oh, God, yes, the hard questions. Wait a minute. We kept records. I can't speak to it because I don't have it in front of me. And it was a few years ago. But all previous shows would do gate clicks. So every time somebody walked in, they'd get a click. They had guards around with clickers or tollers, whatever they're called. We didn't. We based ours on unique registrations. That was it. So if you registered to go to the show and you picked your ticket up, you got one click. It didn't matter how many times you walked in and out.
Right.
Now, we calculated by guesstimate, no other way, that the average person would enter and leave the show, the average person, meaning the participants in the show, 25 to 40 times. So you got to go to the bathroom, you know. You want to get a snack, or you want some fresh air, or you go home and you're there for the what was it? It was a 10-day show or something like that. So, you know, you're in and out 20 times just to come and go without stepping out to go to a lecture, to go to an auction or whatever. So we kept it. We did it differently. And people were said, oh, that's all you had. You know, previous shows that had 5 times or 10 times that. Well, we didn't keep methods. We believe our way is the better way.
Right. And more accurate way.
Of course. We want to know how many people are registered. That's all that matters. Not just registered, rather, but picked their badges up from the front desk, which means they not only registered, but they attended.
Yeah.
So registration was free. So anyone could have registered, not shown. So we did it that way, and we felt that was honest. We wanted to set a new method of tracking who really shows up at the show.
Of course. What have your collecting habits been since the pandemic? Have you increased in buying, increased in different topics that you collect? I know you named about 20 different things that you're interested in, but have you picked up any more? I mean, it must be, you know, difficult to not buy, difficult to not collect at times like these.
I play around more with my stuff than I used to because I'm sort of homebound more so than previously. So I go through my stuff and thinking about doing my Liberty exhibit, putting it together. I probably have 40 frames of material that I have to sort through to come up with what, you know, I have to figure out what system to use to set the exhibit up. What am I? It's going to be on rates. But, you know, what do you include and what don't you when you have that much material? I've been collecting it for a couple of decades. So that should be fun. That keeps me occupied. But as far as buying stuff, I have dealers that know me and look for stuff for me and are in touch. Mm-hmm. And I look through auction catalogs and see what's there and so forth. From what I understand from dealers and auction houses, they're doing a great business.
Yeah.
I guess because people can't go to shows, number one. Number two, they're homebound, so they have more time to focus on their collections. I know memberships in many organizations philatelically are on the increase. So there's more attention being paid to the hobby right now than previously. But I haven't gotten into anything new. It's weird. The way I find new stuff is, when I say new stuff, I mean new collections, not new material for an existing collection. The way it is by going around to different dealers, saying hello, and then all of a sudden they have something. When I look at it, I say, wow, this is cool. You know, they go. So you can't really do that on the internet.
Right.
At least I can't. I'm a tactile kind of guy and a visual.
Yeah, it speaks kind of to what brought you back into the hobby, just looking at an envelope.
Oh, wow. That's just amazing. Yeah, it was so different because the stamps up until then, the previous 20 years or so, looked like posters.
Yeah.
They didn't look like these stamps. I grew up with the Liberty Series. I'm a child of the 50s. I was born in 1949, and the Liberty Series were around then. My dad had a company in Manhattan, a small high-end ladies finishings, let's call it, stuff they sold to Saks Fifth Avenue, Lord & Taylor, Best & Company, all these high-end shops. He made boutique stuff. And he had a shipping department. So on Saturdays, everybody worked a half a day on Saturdays in the 1950s, a different time. It was a five-and-a-half-day work week. He would take me in sometimes on Saturday, and I'd work in the shipping department upstairs, which means I was out of my dad's hair. And working with the fellow that ran the shipping department. And he let me put the stamps on the parcels. So remember, UPS is in their infancy at this point. They had what's called blue label service for UPS, which went to some eastern states, Atlanta, California, and that's about everything else that was in the middle of the country, maybe Chicago. Everything else that was in the middle of the company had to go by the postal service. And putting stamps on, you know, so my dad had sheets of the $5 Hamilton that I would just pull apart and stick on parcels, you know. It was my job to weigh and calculate it. Then the shipping guy would verify that I got it right. And then I would take the parcel, put it down, pull the stamps off, put them on top of the parcel unlicked. And he'd verify that I had added it up right. I was a little kid. And
that you increased the amount of work twofold, basically.
Yeah, I probably slowed the guy down major. But, it was exposure. And then in the summer months when I was off from school, my dad would take me in once in a while. So it was fun. He was on East 30th Street between Madison and Park South.
It's crazy to think that such something that brought such an influential and important person in the philatelic world back to the hobby is something that we don't really deal with anymore because we've got metered postage. You know, so many people use metered postage on absolutely anything. I don't remember the last time I saw something actually received mail with an actual stamp that wasn't from a stamp dealer or a collector. That's got to really be affecting the hobby
I would say the lack of a cohesive series of definitive stamps is probably. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the transportation coils, the prominent Americans, there were these great series that went all the way from the half cent up to the $5 or so. And I think that's something that, at least for Michael and I, as relative newcomers, we were never exposed to that growing up. Yeah. Where you try and collect one of each Liberty, one of each prominent American, one of each transportation coil. And I wonder if, you know, what sort of negative influence that has on the hobby, that there's just no exposure to young people with the mail. Hmm.
I think it's huge that mail no longer comes into the home. As Michael pointed out, almost everything is indicia or meters.
Yeah.
Actually, I think indicia might actually overshadow the amount of metered mail I get with actual meters on them. But and the junk mail, nothing has stamps on it. Some of my most prized Liberty items are items that came with stamps on them, little, you know, from my church, a box of stamps, a box of donation envelopes with the stamps, actual stamps on the little cardboard box, stuff like that. That everything is indicia now, or prepaid or whatever. So it's kids don't know what stamps are. I remember at my company, we had about 60 people on one floor that I went to at one point. This was in the 1990s, probably the late 90s. I don't remember what the first class postal rate was, but I yelled out to everybody, can anyone tell me for a free lunch, what is the first class postage rate? And they looked at me like I was asking them how many pounds of thrust it took to get a Gemini capsule into space. There's a lot of people. These are smart kids. These are all college graduates, recent college graduates. They had no idea what the Postal Service was. We don't use the mail. We use email. I don't know if text was even around back in the late 90s. I think it was called SMS or whatever the heck it is. Just different. So you're right. The lack of exposure to stamps themselves, physical stamps, are going to have a toll at some point. But, you know, people say, is that the end of stamp collecting? They don't make bottle caps anymore that people collect, per se, yet people collect bottle caps. People collect things because they do. I think we're heading to a coinless society very soon. Before paper money goes, coins will go. Mm. And will people still collect coins? Absolutely. I mean, they're collecting Roman Empire and Greek Empire coins. So I don't think stamp collecting is going away, but it does hamper the ability for people to see stamps coming in and becoming familiar with them.
Hmm.
So it's a detriment, but it's what we live with. Change.
Yeah. Kind of speaking on that same topic, what has been a new or recent innovation that you've seen in the hobby or any kind of any person in the hobby take that's kind of impressed you and thought we should continue down that path to either strengthen the Diz Tube?
Doing it right now.
Yeah.
It's called Zoom.
Okay.
Or whatever you want to call it other than Zoom. Who's that, whether it's Microsoft's team or whatever, I don't even know the names. This is the biggest, if there's, you know, it's hard to say this, and I mean, the horror that this virus has caused. But if there's anything that good that came out for the hobby, it's the fact that people now have virtual meetings. I am probably on 4 or 5 virtual meetings a week, whether it's just with friends or philatelists. I have a group of 7 Classic Society members, a close-knit group that we've been doing email together. We're on an email thread for got to be 12 years. And when this epidemic came, I set up a Zoom account, and I have my own account, and we have this meeting every Thursday at noon Eastern time. And then the Classics Society is doing stuff. The APS is all over it. The Collectors Club has been immensely successful.
And when you gave your Collectors Club talk several weeks or months ago, they do a good job of archiving these. Even before the pandemic, they were posting everything online. But I would almost certainly bet money that more people viewed your virtual Collectors Club talk than ever show up in person to the meetings.
You could have a disinteresting speaker, and you're going to triple the amount of people that you're going to get at the club. The club basically, when it's got a full house, has 60 people. We can't fit more than that, maybe 70 with some people standing. The least attended collectors club talk I'm aware of had 240 people watching.
Wow.
I was telling Michael before we started, 175 of those 240, 250 people, 175 are non-collectors club members. So we're open, we're doing this to service the hobby during this pandemic. And we plan to continue this through the new year. Right now we're scheduled through December, but we're going to continue this onward. This is the way of the future. We're reaching people in foreign countries. We are engendering current members and enticing new members to support us. I think we had 16 new memberships last month. The month before we had 13. Those numbers only exist when there's a world stamp show of some kind somewhere. Every 10 years, we get an influx of people and then they fall off. These are people that appreciate what we're doing. So back to the question. I'm sorry, I do tend to ramble. This Zoom thing, this virtual meetings, I'm attending a Western Cover Society meeting. I believe it's Friday. I have it written on my calendar. I've been to their meetings at Westpex, but Dale Egan got in touch with me and said, would you like to, you know, join us? I said, yeah, sure. What's the format? He goes, oh, we just talk. I said, oh, great. Yeah. You know, people are hungry right now to do things with their friends who they can't see, who they can't fly to, who they don't want to drive to, they don't want to sit in a room with, but at the same time can virtually sit in a room.
And this is something we spoke to Gary Lowe last, we spoke to Alex Hyman first. And I think the common theme that we've been talking about is that it will be great to go to shows again. It will be great to go to the Collectors Club again in person. But the hobby will never, hopefully never, go back to what it was before this pandemic. Even though there may be some reversion to the mean, we need to build on this momentum and continue using these platforms moving forward. We can't just go back to the way things were. These virtual meetings, you know, I still go to the Southern California Collectors Club meetings every month. And I really think that, again, it'll be great to see everyone at a show and, you know, bump elbows with everyone. But we're never going to go back to a pre-Zoom world after all this is.
I hope not. The Collectors Club hasn't voted on it yet. As a matter of fact, our meeting is this evening, our governor's meeting. But we're about a quarter of an inch away with probably unanimity to have, instead of two presentations in person per month at the club, one presentation of a stepped up nature, which I can describe later, and two virtual meetings a month still. So that's how much we've embraced this. It's working for us, and it's getting our name out there. It's entertaining people. One of the things we do beside having the presentation for 40 minutes and then a 15-minute Q&A, after the speaker is done and we thank that person, we join everybody, 200-odd people, onto Zoom. We let them in, so to speak, from a webinar into a Zoom meeting like we're having now. And people can talk, they can screen share. You know, we monitor it. We have two monitors that are watching everything to make sure that we don't get Zoom bombed. But we haven't yet. And, so people get a sense of fraternity. They say, you know, Joe was a great speaker, but wow, this virtual meeting is so great. I get to see, you know, Laverne Harris over here and this person over there. And it means something to people at a time like this. But I think it'll have meaning after this because it enables people to get out, so to speak, virtually without leaving their home. We are an aging society, not society, but you know what I mean? We're an aging hobby. And this also caters to that. So it's just it's a miracle of this horrid virus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wade, this has been fantastic. Michael, I've asked everything I wanted to hear from you, Wade, if Michael has anything else. But more than anything, I would just like to thank you for taking the time. This has been really fun to catch up. I've missed seeing you at the club, but it's good to be able to interact face-to-face, so to speak.
It's my pleasure, guys. I'm glad. I hope this works for you guys, and it becomes, this opportunity to hear and see, so to speak, people that you don't have the opportunity to sit and chat with is amazing. So it's been my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your day.
Take care, guys. Be well. Thank be you safe. Too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael, I thought that was fantastic. Wade is always an enjoyable person to talk to. You know you're in for a laugh whenever you sit down and chat with him. He's just a real character in addition to just being a great collector and a great, great gentleman.
Yeah, crazy easy to speak to. Just a real humble person.
And that's what I love about what we've been doing is you get people out of their element, their stamp shell. And again, you realize how many of these people you'd be friends with even if you didn't have stamps in common.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, this, I guess, could have gone in the news introductory segment, but just one last thing I'd love to touch on. I know there's been a lot of questioning of subject matter for new postage stamps that the post office is putting out, the U.S. Mm-hmm. Postal Service. Maybe none of them have gotten the criticism this year as Bugs Bunny, who is now on a sheet of 20 stamps with 10 different designs. And on the one hand, it's really easy to sort of scoff at Bugs Bunny and say, that doesn't belong on stamps alongside George Washington or the Pilgrims get a stamp this year. Does Bugs Bunny belong? But then you talk to Wade, who first got into serious collecting, adult collecting through the transportation coils, which, mm-hmm. again, it's really easy to sort of look down your nose at from a historical point of view. Or I think the artistry of those stamps is undeniable, but right. It is funny. Again, it's easy to say, why is Bugs Bunny on 10 different stamps? And then you never know who that one kid who picks up the Bugs Bunny stamps is, who gets bitten by a bug that lasts their entire life. So I think what Wade said really, again, you can debate the merits of different subjects for postage stamps. But what Wade said really helped. I think it was humbling and sort of put things into perspective.
Yeah, yeah. You see the youth booths at all the stamp shows, or at least you used to. When we were going to them still, but
good old days.
The good old days. And you have to wonder that those stamps are definitely going to be making it to those youth booths to try and engage young collectors. But at the same time, a lot of them might not know who Bugs Bunny is.
True. It's sort of a fine line you have to walk. You don't want to just sell your soul and put SpongeBob or Paw Patrol or something.
Right. Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it is important to remember that maybe we're not the audience. Maybe there's a bigger picture to consider. So again, Wade, that's something I've been wanting to talk to you about, the appropriateness of subject matter for U.S. postage stamps, which is a conversation we could have for hours, I'm sure.
Right.
And maybe we will someday, depending on our guest. But again, I think what Wade said really just helped put that in perspective. So that's my closing thought for the day is I appreciated him reminding us that, you don't have to collect 1847s. You don't have to collect Hawaiian missionaries. You can collect the transportation coils. You can collect Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. Topical stamps are still a huge area in collecting.
Absolutely. And we're all coming at it from the same place. Again, whether you're going to the post office to buy Bugs Bunny or spending $20,000 on a cover, comes from the same place in our heart, I think.
Right.
So that's my philosophical thought for the day.
Well, it's one I share as well.
Excellent. Well, who do we have up next week? What's next on the agenda for us?
Next week, I believe we have Joe Mullen, executive director of the Spelman Museum.
Absolutely. And that should be a fantastic conversation. I haven't been to the Spelman myself, but obviously their digital presence and the work they've done, not just at their physical location, but across the rest of the country has been fantastic.
Yeah, I've only been a couple times myself. It's an interesting place. I think he just got appointed a year or so ago. We can have him clarify that. next week. But I'm excited to see the direction that he takes the museum and what they're doing currently to keep people engaged.
It's a weird time to take over a brick and mortar museum. I'm sure. Exactly. I'm sure he's sick of being asked about this, but we'll be sure to figure out again what it's like to run a museum in 2020 in the midst of a global pandemic.
Yeah, it's a question on everyone's mind.
So once again, for people who want to listen to us, Michael, where can they find us?
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, YouTube, and hopefully soon on Spotify as well.
It's funny. I actually subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, so now I get a notification every time one of these things goes live. So
I'm glad we're at least letting you know.
And I was going to say, if anyone should know, it's myself.
Right.
So again, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, all the usual, YouTube, yeah. All the usual suspects.
Right. And if anyone wants to reach out to us for any reason whatsoever, except for hate mail, you can reach us at philatelypodcast@gmail.com.
And what's the email for hate mail? What's your personal
none
email?
None@none.com.
So that's philatelypodcast@gmail.com?
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. We'll be on next week to talk to Mr. Mullen.
All right. Sounds great.
See you then.
Bye.